It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk reporting in not from my usual perch in the media capital of the world, New York City, but instead from out on the road, traveling overseas. Last week I was in London, England, and now I'm in Dublin, Ireland, to bring you the Media Beat for the weekend beginning November 3rd, 2023. One media matter, a question of perspective, is always clear to me whenever I jump from London to Dublin. I'm now in a European capital. That's a status that London has totally abandoned since Brexit in 2020. That was when the enabling legislation for the national divorce was famously ridiculed by its many disgruntled critics in the press, the many Euro enthusiasts, as, and I quote, "the longest suicide note in history." Here in Dublin, there is no doubt we're decidedly part of the European Union still, and will stay so. And it's a lot more than the everyday practical fact that the euro is the currency that now jingles in our pocket. The broader continental outlook is an overarching fact of life, a culmination perhaps of the complete revolution that has in recent decades overtaken Ireland's sense of itself. Revolution is not an exaggeration, though I suppose step-by-step but speedy and enormous transformation would be more strictly accurate. Ireland will be remembered by many as a tight little, backward, isolated island state dominated by the Catholic Church. But since the 1990s, with membership of Europe undoubtedly part of the process, the country has made divorce and abortion and same-sex marriage all legal, and much other liberalization besides. It's made it an attractive place to live for many, and that's a big change. Ireland has even shifted from once being an exporter of its own people to being a net importer. The cheery streetscape of Dublin exults in, even some days positively vibrates with, a cosmopolitan mix of multiple ethnic, racial, and national differences. And along with that internationalist climate, Irish journalism displays a welcome global outlook as well. It has its echoes in diplomatic and even transnational military activity. Long-time listeners to the Media Beat will know I spent a dozen years or more working with the United Nations, and I always found the Irish remarkably disproportionate for their presence in UN agencies, in its decision-making processes, and perhaps most vividly, in the Irish Army regiments that repeatedly make up UN peacekeeping forces throughout the world's crisis-ridden trouble spots. In the journalistic realm, I'd like to commend the global coverage to be found in that foremost Irish newspaper, the Irish Times, founded in 1859. It's especially commendable considering the limits on its resources. After all, the paper depends financially on a readership market that's restricted in size by the country's overall population of only 5 million people, even counting its new waves of immigrants. But despite its constrained budget, the Irish Times nonetheless covers the world with exemplary aplomb. A notable instance of that coverage, one which has great relevance right now, is a sharp reporter and distinctive commentator called Michael Janssen. Despite that forename sounding conventionally male, Michael, this correspondent is a woman, and an American-born woman who has long covered the Middle East, and like many reporters of the region, she was forced during the Lebanese Civil War in the 1970s to leave Beirut and move to a Cyprus base with her husband and fellow journalist Godfrey Janssen, who has since died. Michael now keeps up a steady supply, of course, of authoritative reporting on the Israel-Hamas war, along with its many outward repercussions. Most notable about her as an individual, perhaps, is that she's a convert to Islam. This doesn't affect her journalistic objectivity, but it very clearly adds to her authority on many dimensions of the conflict. I haven't seen much in the international press to match Janssen's side analysis of Egypt's position in the war. She went into great explanatory detail to explain the various pressures on President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. She laid out clearly why Egypt is unwilling to accept long-term refugees from Gaza, beyond the sick and injured it is taking into its hospitals, any more than Jordan's King Abdullah feels he can take in any more Palestinians. Both leaders have evidently been trying to persuade Israel to transfer the beleaguered Gazans to the Negev Desert, a proposal that not many of the world's media have expressed any great interest in reporting. Egypt's own population is now expressing revulsion that their country was the first Arab nation to sign a peace treaty with Israel at Camp David back in President Jimmy Carter's time. But al-Sisi is refusing to pull out of the 40-year-old deal, despite many demands that he should. Janssen pointed out tellingly that al-Sisi faces elections only next month, which are bound to be affected by the war, and he, of course, is doing his typically dictatorial best to crack down on political dissent. So with Michael Janssen as one microcosmic example, this Irish corner of Europe is being well served in coverage of the wider world. It's instructive to see and hear UNICEF Ireland, the local support group for the International UNICEF Agency, at work in its public outreach. It is covering the whole country with appeals aired on the National Broadcasting Service, Radio Telefish Éireann, RTE, which is state-owned but maintains its editorial independence and gains income from a non-governmental source, advertising. UNICEF Ireland has to pay to get its appeals broadcast. The current appeals are not surprisingly for aid to Gaza, and they see the crisis through the specialized lens of the Global Children's Agency, in particular the appalling metric it applies to this conflict, the 420 children it calculates are being killed every day now. Losses that have been highlighted further by the bombing of Gaza's biggest refugee camp of Jabalia, and images that have come to us of children carrying other, evidently dead, children through the camp's ruins. To change the subject, I should also say as a dedicated media observer that RTE provides less serious forms of content as well. Material that is often very local in flavour, but still carries echoes and resonances of a wider kind. In fact, I've had my interest piqued since arriving here by a drama series, a crime mystery with more than a dash of comedy to it, that premiered on air this fall. The series has a journalistic setting, a local Irish newspaper, in fact, but it deals with a subspecialty in journalism that can provide us practitioners with some terrible professional anxieties. The series is called simply Obituary, the creation of screenwriter Ray Lawler, and the Irish gift for humour spins the subject in a variety of farcical ways, even while, as I say, it's a journalistic realm that's full of darkly serious pitfalls. Not least among the dangers is the fact that obituaries are usually, certainly in the case of prominent or famous subjects, written in advance of the subject's death and kept on ice, as it were, to be published when that death happens. And, of course, accidents can happen. The French Global Service, Radio France Internationale, will probably never live down its shocking accidental publication of over 100 advance obituaries. It was updating its database when it released the obituaries, which appeared to be killing off notables like Queen Elizabeth, Clint Eastwood, Pelé, the soccer giant, and former President Jimmy Carter. This was 3 years ago, and at that time they were all still alive. It also prematurely announced the death of a French businessman, Bernie Tapie, an unfortunate fellow in that he had already, because of other mistakes made elsewhere, actually been declared dead twice before. So innocent errors can be expected to happen, I suppose, and especially during a tech upgrade, a modern bane of our life, it seems. But how can a media organization guard against the chance that someone might be deliberately faking their own death? That did happen with Alan Abel, an American hoaxer who did just that, and even fooled the New York Times into publishing his obituary. He was an inveterate fraudster, making a career out of tricking the media into covering his phony exploits. In different guises, he convincingly passed himself off as running for president, and in one case got further than you might expect by having his wife pose as a candidate, called Yetta Bronstein from the Bronx. His slogan for her was, "Vote for Yetta and things will get better." Their campaign promises included a mink coat for every woman who supported Yetta, and if she were elected, she would pour a truth serum into Congress's water supply. But Abel's faking of his own death, unlike any presidential run, was a success. The result of much meticulous planning, a dozen accomplices backed up the story that Abel had suffered a fatal heart attack while location scouting in Utah for a horror movie. It had a bold title, that non-existent movie, "Who's Going to Bite Your Neck, Dear, When All of My Teeth Are Gone?" But it wasn't weird enough to trouble New York Times editors, apparently. The Times was notified by a persuasively grieving widow. Another friend posed as an undertaker to answer all fact-checking calls from journalists. Abel's obituary was published on January 2, 1980, and the next day he held a gleeful press conference to rejoice in his success. Abel died, for real, in 2018. His second New York Times obituary carried the headline, "Alan Abel, Hoaxer Extraordinaire, is Dead at 94. On good authority, the Times felt it had to add. This time, the fact-checkers had double-checked with both hospice and his funeral home, genuinely verified as real. The Irish TV series obituary has a sort of credible plotline. The local paper is facing commercially hard times, like all local papers, and among many staffing cuts, it forces its obituary writer, neatly played by Siobhan Cullen, a winning Generation Z actor, to turn freelance, and as such, she gets paid differently. By the death, to put it crudely. I think you can see where this is going. Such other ways obituarists might become serial killers. I found the storytelling a little convoluted and forced at times, and I made things worse on myself by initially, mistakenly, not starting at the beginning, one of the perils of streaming platforms dropping the complete bundle of a multi-part series all at once. A much more diligent critic than I, Ed Power, a culture commentator at the Irish Times, gave the series a fair assessment as a whole. He said that RTE had tried something different, looking beyond what he's found to be the conventional clichés of homegrown Irish dramas, and he said, "You can only applaud the killer premise." That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.